Welcome to the Geekcentric Podcast, and welcome to our spoiler-free review for Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery. It is time to discover what this flock of wicked wolves is hiding. Welcome to the Geekcentric Podcast. My name is Nate, and this is our spoiler-free review for Wake Up Dead Man, A Knives Out Mystery. A huge thanks to our friends at the Toronto International Film Festival for accrediting us for the festival so we could watch this movie early for review. If you're joining us for the first time, we are Geekcentric, a podcast celebrating the world of movies, TV shows, games, and all things geekcentric. And today, I'm joined by two mystery-loving, trusted compatriots in the pursuit of clarity. First up is the jargon-unraveling, judgment-defying, jewel-tongue, joke-juggling Justin Lawrence.
Wow, that accent is something, eh?
I think it's perfect.
It turned your accent into an SH.
If you're listening to this, you close your eyes. I'm pretty sure it's just, you're hearing Benoit Blanc. Like, that's... You're picturing him in your head.
Maybe if you've never seen him before, sure, and or heard him before, maybe.
And listen, out of the fog, a foghorn, out of the fog, in the distance stumbles the detail-detecting, doubt-dispelling, devilishly debonair, Darcy the Humdinger Hudson.
See, that one sounds different now.
Yes, I was going to say, completely new accent. Like, you had when you're
when you go from movie to movie, you want to give the audience a little something new each time. You know what I mean?
It's not the accent changing. I don't remember Daniel Craig doing that.
You're right. He's a much better Benoit Blanc than I am.
He's perfected that character, like that voice, like to a T. It's pretty wild.
I think so. You're talking about me? Okay.
No, talking about Daniel Craig. Talking about the one that actually knows how to do it.
but how are you guys doing? Ready to talk about another Rian Johnson mystery, another Knives Out movie. Before we dive in, what for each of you, what's your experience been with the Knives Out iverse, the Knives Out CU? What do we, I don't know what we'll call it, but
I think any other name but what you just listed would be better. Listen, the whodunit universe would probably been the Rian Johnson whodunit universe.
The Knives Out cinematic universe.
Oh my God.
Stop the accents, please. Yeah,
geez, just
they keep changing and none of them are working.
For me, I really enjoyed the first one. I thought that was like, that's a very high bar. I wasn't a big fan of the second one. Mm. I think it still had like some things to love about it, but it really didn't meet the high bar that the first one did for me. So, you know, going into this one, I was a little, you know, not worried, I guess, but more hesitant and just in terms of like, what are we going to get? You know, again, like we've been kind of talking as you've been doing this very bad accent, you know, Daniel Craig is phenomenal as this character. And he's so engaging. He's so enthralling. It's just, he's, you know, the way he commits to the bit is incredible. And I think he has been like this anchor point for this series, and the colorful characters that he's surrounded by in each of these movies is delightful. They're all bringing something unique. I think for me, based on the first one to the second one, it was the narrative, the story that just, I don't know if it really worked for me. I think it kind of was a bit of a, it just felt like we were rehashing what number one had already done so well, but just with a different collective of characters and obviously a different outcome and so on. But yeah, it just felt like by the end of it, I was like, did we really need a sequel to something that was so special and what was so of a moment, just being incredibly successful for just being what it was, a very contained whodunit that focused around a family that really did carry the first one in a very, very positive way.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think I love the first one. Again, like you're saying, it's very special. And when I first saw Glass Onion in theaters for, with you and Kev, Nate, for review last year, I really mm-hmm. liked it. And I think I gave it a glowing review, I'm pretty sure, when we did our review. But upon rewatches, it's not as enjoyable as that first one because, like Justin said, like it's trying to recapture the magic that the first one was because of the dynamics. They're like, okay, what's close to a family? Well, how about a bunch of friends who've known each other forever? And these characters are larger than life, much like the first one, but they didn't have the same vibes or fit as well together as that first cast did. So I think it's come down a bit in my opinion of how much I liked it, but it's a great whodunit. And again, Daniel Craig being this the world's greatest detective is one of the most enjoyable things to see. And I will watch him go solve any case, even if it is a rehash, because just listening to him talk and be this character is just so good.
And to wax poetically.
Oh yeah. He says Scooby-Doo in this movie, and it is the greatest thing I've ever heard.
It's so good. and just the way he can go on, and like, you're waiting for that moment when he's just like, I figured it out. And then he just goes through, you know, breaking it down. And with that Southern draw, you know, like he does it so well. It's just such a great character that he's designed. So I can understand why there's a desire to want to continue telling more stories just from the perspective of having him. But yeah, I wonder if we're, you know, even with this one, and we'll talk about it, but it does feel like, you know, you'll never really capture what made the first one so special. Right. Yeah. And all of these just feel like they're just treading on the I guess the term is the coattails of the first one to kind of, you know, keep that alive in some respects. So yeah.
Well, I think when we saw that first one, you know, there was that magic. We didn't know that it was necessarily a formula. I don't even know if it was necessarily decided by Rian Johnson that it would almost feel like a formula of like, okay, there are things that are going to feel very Knives Out, and we got them in the second one, we got them in this one. So I'm excited to talk about sort of what those are, what hit, what missed. But before we get into all of it, let me give you a synopsis. Don't worry, I won't do an accent. Detective Benoit Blanc teams up with an earnest young priest to investigate a perfectly impossible crime at a small town church with a dark history. This is the latest Benoit Blanc mystery from director Rian Johnson, and it stars yet again another stacked cast, including Daniel Craig, Josh O'Connor, Glenn Close, Josh Brolin, Mila Kunis, Jeremy Renner, Kerry Washington, Andrew Scott, Kaylee Spaney, Daryl McCormick, Thomas Hayden Church, and Jeffrey Wright. The film had its Canadian debut at the Toronto International Film Festival, which is where we watched it, but it's also going to be available in select theaters on November 26th. And then, if you don't want to get out to the theaters to see it, it will be on Netflix on December 12th, 2025. So, you know, I mentioned right before I got into that synopsis that there are these things that seem to carry from film to film. We're in the third movie in this franchise, if you will, so far. And there's definitely a lot in terms of the way these movies look, the way they're captured. So I wanted to start there with the look and feel. And I want to throw it to either of you just to kick it off. What did you think of the way that this one looked this time around?
I mean, he knows how to shoot a mystery movie and make it look good and draw intrigue through the scenery and everything he's filling the shot with. So, I mean, that hasn't changed. That's one of the things that is a constant throughout these movies and is always really good. The imagery in this one and some of the shots are stuff that you'll remember for a while and are just so Knives Out now. So take it if you want. If you're tired of that, then maybe this one's not for you. But if you like that, you're going to love the way this movie looks. And again, the feel of it, the way that he crafts the mystery and all the misleads and misdirects that he manages to weave in right before your eyes. And when you think you're on the right page and you're all of a sudden it's ripped out from underneath you and you're in a completely different book. It's always a fun time when he's telling these stories. So again, that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I think like the look of this film really does lean into its atmosphere. And I think that's a big part of why it works. You know, the cinematographer, Stephen Yedlin, gives the film this gorgeous, moody, gothic vibe that feels like a big shift from the bright, sunny, drenched beach of the Glass Onion. So this does feel like a return to form in the whodunit world. And you know what really stands out is just how intentional the lighting feels. Like, light isn't just showing the scenes, it's telling the story in a lot of ways. And, you know, the way, you know, characters can, you know, disappear into shadows or, you know, appear from shadows, or, you know, that the warm glow, or the way light is used to like highlight moments of serenity while also using those dark moments or those transition moments from light to dark to kind of highlight something sinister. It all just felt deliberate. And Yedlin is known for setting up his lighting using like a black and white stills method, which is, it's very classic cinematographer technique. It helps you judge the contrast and the shape of the light before you start using color or you start implementing color, which can get in the way of the thing. So it's really just looking at it as like a very monotone picture, so you can understand the sort of layers to your image. And you can absolutely feel that in every shot. It just, every shot just feels like the light is sculpted, almost handcrafted in a way. And, you know, I think that all of this just pairs really well with the production design, which was very gothic. You know, the stony textures of the church, you know, the dimly lit hallways, and everything just helped to highlight some of the architectural aspects of the church, as well as other venues that are featured in the film. And, you know, I just think the whole film really does pull in this murder mystery vibe from a look and feel standpoint. It's great. And then you obviously layer in things like music, and then it goes even further, right? And from that perspective. So, you know, I think this movie feels like a return to that whodunit style that I feel like Glass Onion was missing.
Yeah, I think there were some really interesting shots in Glass Onion that definitely stand out. I think about the way they use the light in that hallway scene when the lights go out, the way they use the what are those lights called? The watchtower
light,
or the searchlight, you know, to kind of bring that in and keep that movement going. And it at times it was very like, I don't know, just the silhouettes were really, really cool. And it did feel kind of scary and different things like that. But I think this one, you're right, Justin, it does feel like more of a return to form, especially with that atmosphere, with the forest and with the way that they're kind of doing things. The framing, I think Steve Yedlin does another great job with framing. If you like those really cool frame shots that you remember from the first two, they have them here. Look out for a phenomenal stained glass framing of one of the characters, or you know, and you mentioned the lighting as well. And it's funny because Darcy, and I think you and I were talking about, there's this one scene where Benoit is basically just sort of giving a little bit of a soliloquy, if you will. And he's talking about something very positive and the lighting's so angelic and lovely. And then by the time he gets to talking about the negative things that, you know, yeah, he's going more negative.
Shifts to the
it shifts thing. And it's dark and it's scary, mm-hmm. and it's cold. And it's one of those things that does feel like a magic trick. Like, it feels like, I know it's movie making, and I know there's so much planning that goes into it, but I know, Darcy, you and I were kind of trying to figure out in our heads, we're like, do you think maybe, like, how cool would it have been if that was just a mistake or just a natural serendipitous happenstance,
okay,
that the sun would do that or a cloud would move in front of the sun or something like that?
I like how you're saying we were talking about this. That was your idea. And
for
I was
sure.
I'm pretty sure it was planned. This is a movie we're talking about. But yeah,
no, I think the coolest part about it is how it does feel.
Yes.
Again, you get so wrapped up in, again, the performances, the music, the lighting, the way the movie's shot, that it just starts to feel more and more natural. And as much as you are amazed by the craft of the movie, you're also sort of drawn in and pulled into
yeah,
it. And
that
it,
is
it just,
that is movie magic. And
magic.
That's, again,
yeah,
there's
yeah,
a lot of moments of that. Again, the frames that you're talking about that in this movie. So it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the idea around, you know, to do things like that from a lighting perspective is actually pretty easy if you just perch a massive light really high up through that main window that is, like, it could be nighttime outside, but if they have a light like that, they can make it look like daylight on the inside and immediately shift the light so that it starts to kind of, you know, look like darkness. So again, all of it just felt overly intentional and deliberate, to the point of where it almost seems like it's being meta. Like, more meta with itself, like more self-aware of the murder mystery quality of their story and the elements that are at play. Like, even when we talk about characters. This is about all of them, but I think even from the second one to now, they're becoming more characters. They are kind of like staple people of this world that we're in. I don't know if that makes sense without getting too much into it, but again, all of that with what we're talking about here and the sort of the intentionality with some of the set design and the look and feel and being, you know, very moody. It feels like this one is really leaning into like knowing it's a murder mystery, whodunit, and, you know, having fun with it from that perspective.
Yeah. And the way that lights are also used to help progress that mystery, right? To help hide different parts of the story as they're revealed. And Justin, you mentioned the music, director Rian Johnson's cousin, Nathan Johnson, I think is giving with this movie exactly, again, it's when we think of the things that I want from a Knives Out movie, he's right here again. He's got those biting strings. He's got the sweeping, you know, high energy music while the mystery is actually being revealed on screen. And then I also think that there's a touch of a lot of like angelic moments, right? Because there is a religious yeah. tone to this story very much so and very intentionally. But I just I really loved the way that this this score just fits so perfectly within the world. And I just hope that, you know, we're obviously going to get more of these. I just it's got to be Nathan Johnson every time because that score was awesome. But Justin, you brought up the performances.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we got to start with the Southern debonair himself.
I thought we stopped with
Darcy,
this.
Darcy, what did you think of Daniel Craig as Benoit Blanc?
Again, he's the reason why you want to keep watching these movies is because he is such an entertaining character. And the way he, again, just following him along on the his process and whatever situation he's in is always an enjoyable time. And just with each movie, he finds the character more and becomes more of the character. I don't know. He just finds another corner that we didn't know about Benoit Blanc and takes us there in a new direction. And in this one, I think it was really cool because the way that they kind of paired off with, like every movie they pair him with someone, but this one he really feels like the entire movie he was a buddy cop mentality with Josh O'Connor's father Judd, and it was just something about that mentality I really liked, and I felt very engaging this time around. So I think it's, again, he does a great job of playing with the cast around him, and this time Father Judd was almost the perfect person to pair up against the loud and debonair Benoit Blanc, which is great.
Yeah, I feel like you're gonna be if you're going into this movie, like you said, you're gonna be counting down the moments until we finally get, you know, him walking through the door. He does take a little while to do that in this movie, which is a little bit might not work for everyone. I understand why they do it. He is his most Benoit Blanc, so it's very rewarding when we do get him and we get to hear him say things like Scooby-Doo or flip the meat, or he references a meme or something like that that he doesn't, his, you know, his Southern sensibilities don't really know what that actually means, and it's a lot of fun. But Justin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, as Darcy said, he's the reason that you want to watch these movies, but like you just said, he is the highlight, but he's not in the movie as much as you would expect, is what I would say. I think that he's obviously very integral. He's on the case, but the way they shift the formula, which again we'll talk about in story, but it changes how much of Benoit we get, and I was really surprised by that. And I think when he's on screen, he brings that charm, that eccentric behavior that just anchors this series. That feels like he in himself, he is Knives Out in its entirety, right? And you know, there's just noticeably less of him, and the story feels a little bit lighter because of it, in my opinion. And I do think that the rest of the cast is very strong, and everyone brings a sense of personality. And again, they're their own characters. They feel like characters of people that they're trying to portray as part of this, you know, massive whodunit, similar to how we got the characters in the family of characters in the first one, and the group of friends in the second one. This is no different, you know, but I do think from the perspective of one thing that might have worked with the first two that didn't work with this one is how they were all interconnected in the previous two, and this one they weren't. But there's definitely some fun chemistry, and I think everyone's delivering, you know, fantastic performances and understands the role of who their character is. But I do think that that was something that that was just kind of missing for me. But I know you guys will probably bring up other characters that I can jump in and talk about. But I just wanted to say that right off the bat about all the characters, that their performances were outstanding, and they all did really, really well.
Yeah, it's a very stacked cast. And I, you know, obviously, if we took the time to talk about literally all of them, this would be probably a 4-hour podcast.
I know, so, there's a lot of them.
So we probably shouldn't do that. But Darcy, you did mention Josh O'Connor. I do want to bring him up again. I think he's an incredible lead as our sort of our lead outsider. I think he's the perfect vessel for the audience in this. And I think he's got that similar level of charm and down on his luck element as Marta, as Andy. And I think you quickly want to root for this guy, because the way that they paint him, especially within the world of religion, especially Catholic religion, and usually how strict it is, you see that he's not afraid to get in fights. He's not afraid to be very honest. And he's, at the end of the day, he just wants to do his job as a priest of God. And there's something really lovely about someone who again, is able to recognize their faults within this flock of people with a lot of issues, a lot of faults themselves, who aren't able to, or just completely ignorant of it. It's really lovely. And you immediately, you know, latch on to Father Judd pretty quickly in this film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask each of you, who did you want to bring up?
Well, again, like, the whole cast is great. And I think one of my favorite things about this, you know, kind of formula change or shift up is the fact that though the interconnectivity is lost, it makes more sense for me for these large personalities like you're talking about, or these big characters, to be drawn to be someone of power if it is the priest of this small town. But it makes sense that that's why the closer inner circle would be these larger than life characters, because they wield power. Just, it makes more sense story wise than just a group of friends who luck into being all rich and powerful, except for the one of them. So I don't know. I like the vibe of this. And again, it's hard to pick call any one person, but I guess the big downfall with having such a stacked cast is you don't spend enough time with all of them. This movie could have been 4 hours, because these characters are all so enjoyable and you only get snippets of each of them. But if I had to call out any one, I guess I'd say I really enjoyed Andrew Scott's Lee Ross, a sci-fi author who's retreated to this small town, and just the neurotic tendency he brings to this character. You understand why he's where he is in life. And I don't know, again, I wish we had more time with him.
Yeah. I agree with you, Darcy. I think that's where the idea of a character, these people are just serving a role to the larger story, comes from, is this idea of how these characters are set up, the lack of interconnectivity to them. And also just the fact that they're serving a part in the larger story. And you know, I really loved Mila Kunis. I think she was great in this. You know, she brings this sort of assertive charm to the role as a sheriff, as I think her name is Geraldine Scott, which I think is great. She is also a bit of a smaller character. The character that I really enjoyed, though, was Josh Brolin. I think he was just absolutely ridiculous. And again, just as I'm saying, just a character upon itself what was his name again? Jefferson?
Monsignor Wicks. Jefferson Wicks.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a mouthful. We'll just call him Jefferson. Monsieur. Jefferson Wick. He was great. He was fantastic. And I think he's an interesting character. The way his mannerisms are, it feels like it's like Josh Brolin just having fun in this character, right? Like just totally embracing it. So yeah, I really enjoyed his character as well.
Yeah, and sorry, just really quick before you go on. His character is the exact definition of everything that's wrong with putting your eggs in one basket. And he's to have Father Judd come in and shake up his world, right? This is very much his flock that he's sort of feeding off of. And there's this cringe humor that is so good. And Josh Brolin does it so well when he's going through his confessions with Father Judd. I won't say what he's confessing. I'll leave that as a surprise for when you get to that part of the movie. But you can see how he even uses something like cringe or uncomfortability to, like, as a weapon to in his, it's just one of his weapons in his arsenal to manipulate all the people around him. So yes, I absolutely loved Josh Brolin. Did you guys have anyone else that you wanted to bring up?
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Glenn Close.
You know, oh my gosh.
Absolute veteran actress who's in this film, and she does an outstanding job, and that's all I'll say.
Yeah. I agree with you. And that's the thing though, but like to what both of you are saying, like, I would have loved a little more time with Glenn Close. I would have loved a lot more time with Kaylee Spaney's character, who I thought was really intriguing and had a really interesting sort of side story that I just was like, oh, it just, and it's tricky with these ensemble casts that are so big and these personalities that are so big. I can imagine it is very difficult with a certain, even though this movie has a significant runtime, it's tough to sort of give everyone a chance.
It's the problem with the whodunit, right? Yeah. You need enough people so that you're questioning who did it, right? But then, you know, and you're learning bits and pieces, like you're being drip-feeded like their past in small amounts, so you're trying to figure them out. I think the intentionality around it is to not know enough about them, right? So that you can't really figure out who it is that did it. So I think there is that's part of the the formula, if you will, is that there's so many players on the board that you don't really get to know them, but you understand. But the idea is that all of these performances were so engaging that we as an audience would love to know more about them.
It's a catch 22.
Right? Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Right?
You've got a phenomenal cast. You've got phenomenal
characters.
I want
to know more about Lee Ross's stories. You know what I mean?
It's like, should the intention be just to cast people that aren't as good as these actors? You know what
For
I mean?
Sure. Like, and that's the other thing too. When you cast, when you have a cast like this that commits and delivers, like they're making these characters their own. So there's that's one of the things that helps. Again, in my mind, that's part of the Knives Out formula is a stacked cast of characters that are just going to be bringing like really elevated performances, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the story here. Again, we are going to keep things completely spoiler free, but we're focusing on things like the structure, the way things have changed, some of the elements like you mentioned, Justin, in terms of the connectivity between these characters. I know I also had similar sentiments. I think if I'm just going to kick it off, I do think it's tricky because I both liked and disliked the structure of this movie. I like that they're trying new things. I like that they changed it up. And I think it's a testament to Daniel Craig's talent, like we've been talking about, that he is so good as Benoit Blanc that you want to see him earlier. But in Glass Onion and Knives Out before, it's almost like they're taking more and more time to get to his character. And I understand that they're trying to set up these complicated, you know, characters that aren't him that are trying, you know, they're trying to set up the mystery, but at the same time, like, you want to see him so bad that it's like it just feels a little grating to have to wait so long. I think I counted like about 45 minutes before
40 minutes before
40
he was
minutes
in a movie.
Before we got there. So
yeah,
that said, I do think that from a story perspective, I do think the mystery still very much works with it. I still think it's very compelling. It's an impossible sort of no door murder scenario. And it's the way that they weave it into the dangers around organized religion and the ways that corrupt men and women use religion for their own personal gain, I think is all really, really intriguing and delicious. So I think there's still a lot of elements that definitely worked for me, but that structure change up was a little kind of, I don't know, it kind of threw me off a little bit earlier in the film.
To me, I think it kind of worked. Again, we can't really get into it too much because that would defeat the purpose of spoiler free, but the way that they approach this mystery in terms of how fresh it is when he gets a hold of the case type thing, it makes it feel very real in terms of not like scripted that he's like, oh, mystery happens, boom, he's walking in the door. It kind of works that time has to take, you know, has to lay out a bit before he gets called in or catches wind of this impossible thing. In terms of the impossible mystery, I love the way that Rian Johnson is able to completely mislead you so many times throughout the course of one film. And the fact that, like you said, Justin, we spend so little time with each of these characters that the time we do spend with them, you are immediately like, they seem sketchy. They must be the one who did it. And every time you spend time with a character, your idea changes. And that's just really clever whodunit writing. So that is still on like completely on display in this film, and I really enjoyed that. Again, my issue is though, it feels like there's too many people. You could have taken, you know, two or three characters out to spend a bit more time with others, and I feel like that made it a more rounded experience. But I think what it really boils down to is the fact that the fact that Judd is almost the one leading this investigation is very much his story.
Yeah, it is. Exactly.
And Benoit's a character in it. I really enjoyed that aspect to it because it makes it feel, again, it builds up the idea that this is just a world where these crazy murders happen and Benoit may or may not catch wind. And this one, he does catch wind of it eventually. So I know I enjoyed that approach, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. It felt like it was more of a fable than a traditional whodunit. In a lot of ways, right? Mm. Like in the sense of like how it sets up and does it. And I think, you know, that can be refreshing in its own and it helps to give it its own identity. So like you said, Nate, I can appreciate the fact of Ryan trying to maybe switch it up on this time around to kind of maybe do something a bit different with the formula. And like we've said, like Rian Johnson knows how to write characters. He knows how to, he's lived in this like whodunit world. There's an intentionality to the way he's what he's giving us about characters and what he's not. But even with all of that, none of this captures the tight character nature or the web that we got from the original Knives Out, which was such a standout. And even to a lesser degree, The Glass Onion, you know, the ensemble feels a bit looser and with less Benoit guiding things along in some instances. And, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying there, Darcy, about how it becomes really about, you know, Father Judd's story and him solving the case, which I can appreciate that. But, you know, it does feel like Benoit's more of a side character in this than anything else. And because of that, it's like the stakes just don't hit as hard, in my opinion. But you're right, Nate, like the sort of commentary on organized religion and the effects that it can have, it's very rich in the story, and that helps to kind of give it a sort of an anchor point, if you will. But I don't know, like, you know, it while this film just feels like it's a very stylish return to form and for the whodunit from that like look and feel, it doesn't necessarily feel like, it just feels like we're rehashing that formula again and like the same sort of situation to a certain degree from the past movies. And I think that's where I'm struggling with this film, just like I was struggling with the second one. It doesn't really hit the same way as I had hoped for from a narrative perspective.
Yeah, I think to both your points, and I think Darcy, you mentioned earlier the idea that these characters don't really know each other as well or aren't as tight-knit makes sense given the way that this mystery is set up, given the way that they're manipulated. You know, we're talking about a community, right? So we went from a family to a tight-knit group of friends to a community of people. And I don't know how often you both spend time with your neighbors, but I don't even know who my neighbors are personally, right? So it's one of those things where I understand why that decision was made. But I think there are some easier fixes that could have been implemented to help kind of bring that original magic, that original spark. Because I think the biggest thing that I noticed this time around, and Justin, it's exactly what you're saying in terms of sort of the connectivity of these characters with the first Knives Out movie, and even with Glass Onion, I think you could take, after watching those movies, you could take any two characters, name them, show me a picture of them, and then I can imagine and picture what that conversation would be in my head if you put them in a room together. You know what I mean? Like, I could see what those interactions would be like. I didn't really get that from this, right? I couldn't really fully grasp how these characters were going to interact. And so when they did come together, I found that the chemistry was good from an acting standpoint, but just from a standpoint of like, I don't know, it did feel like there was something very much missing. And I kind of, that caused me to mostly just care about Father Judd and Benoit Blanc as rich as these characters were, as great as they were performed. I just felt it was a little bit more just one-sided, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like, you know, when we talk about like the Knives Out of it, like, you know, it's the formula. I think that formula is what I think of, at least. And like that midway switch that Rian Johnson pulled off in the original Knives Out just worked so brilliantly. It was like it subverted the genre. It recontextualized everything in the moment. And it genuinely surprised people. But now that we've seen variations of the structure, like you know, now two other times, you know, in three different versions, it's, you know, the surprise is gone. You know what I mean? Like there's, you're just waiting for that anticipation of when are we going to switch? When are we going to see another perspective? And it just becomes predictable. It's almost expected. And it doesn't really carry that the same impact that it once did, in my opinion. And that like repetitive twist works against the story in a lot of ways. And instead of building momentum, it interrupts it. And instead of deepening the mystery, it just broadens it in a way that just feels familiar, right? Like you're just waiting for that formula to just happen. And it happened. It might have not happened in the most conventional way like we were used to in the past two, but it still happened and we were just waiting for it. But you know, it because of that anticipation, and you're waiting for that moment when the film is just going to pull the rug from under your feet and just kind of reveal itself and give you all of the answers. And, you know, even a couple times here, they tried to play with subverting that where it's like, oh, you're going to get the answers. No, no, wait. Oh. But like at the end of the day, it just kind of, it ended up happening the way it did. It was just like, it was like a little deke out to say, oh, this is going to be a little bit different from the last time. And I was just like, it's the same thing, right? Like you're just waiting for it to actually happen. So I don't know. I can appreciate what Johnson was trying to do from the tone and what he was doing visually, but like structurally, this just felt like it was stuck in a loop, in my opinion.
I feel like what you just explained is your issue with all whodunits, because like Rian Johnson didn't create the formula. He just kind of reinvented it a bit or modernized it.
But like the whodunit,
most great whodunits, like Agatha Christie, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, like all their characters are very much, they're set in their ways and are thrown into these wild, over-the-top situations where there are a lot of red herrings, or you go down a dead end or down a lead that ends up being false. And it was actually a completely different direction, which is no stranger to any of these whodunit things. So I don't know if it's necessarily a fault of this movie or maybe just the genre of a whodunit.
No, I think it's not. You're right. Like the whodunit genre is like, look at Only Murders in the Building. We're at five seasons of it, and I love that show. And the formula hasn't changed. And we pretty much know what it is. And it's gotten to the point where it's being meta about it. It's being meta about understanding where it is in the case and understanding it. And this one does lean into that to a certain degree from certain aspects. But again, it's this idea of I think, of the overall structure of the story just being like, here's one perspective and then here's the other. Here's one perspective, here's the other. Here's one perspective, here's the other. I'm just waiting for that other perspective because then all the answers will start to slip into place, right? And just like in the second one, I was right with this one about who it was. So it's like,
oh, so you again, predicted it. Yeah.
I predicted it. Yeah, okay. I predicted it. I did. Okay. I totally knew it was, yeah. And like, I predicted it in the second one. I predicted it in the second one, yeah. And I predicted it in the sense that it felt so obvious in the second one. I did not know who it was in the first one, right?
Okay.
But in the second one, it was like, it had to be Edward Norton's character. And in Spoilers. This one, I was like, yes.
For Glass Onion. For
a Glass Onion. If you haven't seen Glass Onion, it's 3 years old.
What are you doing here?
Yeah, what are you doing here? But, you know, for this one, it was definitely the same sort of thing. And I think that, again, is, you know, having that surprise in the first one and feeling like these last two, it's been very, like, I can see it coming kind of thing. I guess that's another part of it as well, right? It's just feeling like you can kind of figure it out before you get there.
Or maybe you're too good of a detective.
Yeah, because I didn't get that either.
Really?
I don't think I predicted.
I will say this though: the circumstances of how.
Yeah.
For this one, no, I didn't understand that.
Yeah.
But I understood that the person that was that person.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Well, we'll see if any of our listeners are listening to this and they've seen
the
movie.
You can email and say, call me bullshit,
I was going to say, no. Yeah, we're going to open up a full investigation. for both of you, let's get to our final thoughts. And I think we should rate this film on a scale of 1 to 5 rocket ships on a mausoleum, which will only make sense once you've seen this movie. Darcy, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, I like a good whodunit. Rian Johnson, again, he manages to mislead me at the very least throughout this journey in terms of who does it. And to me, what's even more important than the who in a whodunit is the how, because with a great whodunit, there's always a cast of characters and any one of them are likely to, but how are they going to get away with it, or how do they expect to get away with it is always what I find really interesting.
Yes, and that is the interesting part. Yeah.
This movie, to me, I think that again, the core feature of this one, the how of it all, really intrigued me, and I really found myself engaged with it. Again, surrounded by the great cast, while we didn't get as much of them as I would have liked, or there maybe were too many for me to spend the time with them I liked, or maybe they were lacking a bit of connectivity, that was the juice that was missing from this one. It wasn't perfect, but it was still incredibly enjoyable for me. So I'll be giving this one 4.5 out of 5.
Rocket ships on a mausoleum.
Okay, 4.5 out of 5 rocket ships on a mausoleum. That is a strange thing to say.
Justin.
I sounded pretty harsh on that story aspect, but I think there is a lot to celebrate about Wake Up Dead Man. Visually, it's one of the most striking films in the series, I think. Again, going back to Stephen Yedlin's moody cinematography, the production design, the church, the gothic vibes, the way the light is used, it all worked really, really well to create a very interesting vibe for this whodunit of Wake Up Dead Man. And you know, the performances, like we said, they're outstanding. I think everyone understood their role, understood what they were doing, and they brought their A game. And Daniel Craig, obviously, you know, having this being his third outing in this series, was as charming as hell. Again, I wish we had a little bit more of him, you know. But like I was saying before, when it comes to the story, the film dips, in my opinion. The repeated formula, the flashback structures, the recontextualizing things, the twists, and the same rhythm that feels the rhythm of reveal that just kind of reframes everything. It just doesn't carry the same impact that it once did. And what felt innovative in the first film now feels tired and predictable, and it holds this entry back, I think, in some ways. If anything, I think what Wake Up Dead Man does, it makes the case that this series didn't need to stretch into multiple movies unless it was willing to just evolve the storytelling approach, right? Beyond what the first one did. You know, there's still so much potential for Benoit Blanc as a character, but I think these mysteries work best when he is the anchor, not when he's pushed to the side. And, you know, it just feels like you're lacking in some aspects. But I understand that there's a case to be made. But I don't know. I think with a fresh formula and, you know, Benoit at the center, I think this could have been a really, like, a stronger chapter, a way to kind of maybe recontextualize the thing and maybe offer something new. I appreciate the craft of what was done here, but I think the story could have taken some bigger approaches and just some bigger swings. So I'm giving this one a 3.5 out of 5 rockets on a whatever it was, Maserati. Or...
Exactly. Rockets on a Maserati, but you got to say it like Benoit.
No, I'm not saying it like
Come on! You almost did it earlier. I'm kind of in between, honestly. I think that's the thing with this movie. It's like, it's the idea of, like, leave them wanting more. And it's like, that's a good thing, and it can also work against you, right? I want to live in this world a little bit longer. I wanted more time with these characters, even though the movie's pretty long. And there's elements about how those characters connected and the pacing and the structure of this movie, to your point, Justin, that I think it's tough when we're in the third of a trilogy so far, and we want it to be like the Knives Out we know, but we want it to be something holistically different. It is tricky to kind of get into that balance, and I don't think that Rian Johnson nailed it with this one. But that said, the cast is all excellent. The music is biting. It is that Knives Out music that you want. You know, I think the character of Benoit Blanc, like you've just been saying over and over again, is phenomenal. Daniel Craig is awesome. And you know, this is a church of people who have fallen under the guidance of a lost man. So again, I understand that their disconnection from each other is what helps push that narrative. I would have rather to have seen this sort of unfold between a tighter group of people. Darcy, I think you nailed it. I think as much as I loved all these characters, maybe getting rid of a few of them, and maybe that might be a fix for future Knives Out stories, right? If we want to have a big bombastic cast, maybe we got to be killing off a few more characters as we go along so that we can spend more time with the ones that are maybe the most important.
Multiple deaths. I like that. That would be, that's probably how you'd switch it up. Yeah.
There you go. Ryan, reach out. We'll work on it together and I won't do my voice. But no, I think despite all the issues that I do have with this movie, I think it's, if you're a Knives Out fan, if you're a fan of murder mysteries, if you're a fan of whodunits, I think you're going to have a really fun time with this movie. I think you're going to appreciate the craft of this movie. And I think that's the other element too, Justin, that you brought up in your final thoughts there, is just like, just how well this movie is made. It is beautiful.
Yeah.
And if you're a fan of just like cinematography, like my cousin is a photographer and he was telling me about some, a movie that he recently saw that he loves. And I was like, dude, just wait till Wake Up Dead Man. You're going to freak out. It's so good. So I'm going to be giving this one a solid 4 out of 5 rocket ships on a mausoleum. I had a good time. But that is it for our spoiler-free review for Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. We hope you enjoyed it. And if you did and you want to share your thoughts on this movie or any of the movies or series we cover, well, I'm going to do it one more time. I'm so sorry, guys. Let me just follow the clues that lead me to the right questions to ask the right people who found themselves here at the wrong time. And the first person to ask is that old jewel-tongued Justin Lawrence. So tell me, Mr. Lawrence, how can the rest of the world reach us?
You sound like a distant relative of his. Or just someone who's over.
If you go back to our old man, Logan video that we did for Master Geek Theater on our YouTube channel, it's a little bit of that. He's in there,
I guess. Yeah. Well, they can reach out to us at wearegeekcentric@gmail.com. That's wearegeekcentric@gmail.com. You can tell us what you think of Nate's lovely southern accent. Or if you want to reach out to us more immediately, you could hit us up on Twitter at GeekCentricYT or on Instagram and TikTok at WeAreGeekCentric.
Keep in mind, we have a ton of other great episodes covering the latest in movies and TV shows, including our recap of the Toronto International Film Festival. It was our first ever TIFF experience, and we had a really fantastic time. You can check out that episode, as well as all of our recent TIFF reviews, like our review for Rental Family, Sentimental Value featuring Eric Marchin, Frankenstein, The Smashing Machine, Nirvana, The Band, The Show, The Movie, and we've got a ton of other reviews from throughout the summer and throughout the year that you can check out. Plus, we've got some great interviews to check out, like our most recent interview with Alex Wu, where he discusses his new Netflix animated film, In Your Dreams. He opens up about how leaving Pixar to launch Cuckoo Studios shaped the kind of stories he wanted to tell, and how revisiting childhood memories became a surprisingly cathartic part of his creative process. And Justin actually spoke to him and really kind of got into some good catharsism questions, if you will. So that was a fantastic interview. You can check out that interview as well as all of our interviews either here on your podcast service of choice or over on YouTube at youtube.com/geekcentric. We've also launched something new, Justin. I don't know about you, but watching Wake Up Dead Man, I got really hungry. Did you get hungry watching this?
No.
When he said
hungry
the
for
meat,
murder,
you didn't get hungry for murder. But listen, I got so hungry. We launched something new after a long mystery-filled review like this. I'm so hungry. You can catch out. You can catch our new side venture, Eatcentric, where we explore food, culture, and the geeky bites that bring people together. In our latest video, we share our thoughts on the holiday smile cookie from our friends over at Tim Hortons. And you can catch all that tasty goodness over on Instagram and TikTok at We Are Eatcentric. The weather's getting colder, but we're still going to heat things up with some coverage for series like Stranger Things 5, Percy Jackson and the Olympians Season 2, and movies like Zootopia 2 and Avatar Fire and Ash. And maybe even one more review from TIFF 50. We'll see. So stay tuned. Be sure to subscribe. You can join us on all that geek-centric goodness. Darcy, Justin, thank you so much for joining me for this Scooby-Doo of a review. And as we say, love ya.
Laters.
Peace.